and welcome to the Science Podcast for January 30th, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, understanding how locusts change from solitary to swarming behavior. Social scientists are working to predict protests in China, and we read from your letters to Science Magazine. All this and more, plus a roundup of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
When desert locusts swarm, sometimes by the billions, they can eat so much that it can threaten the food security of dozens of countries, such as happened with the locust outbreak in 2004. Most of the time, though, desert locusts avoid one another. For decades, scientists have been studying what causes the behavioral switch from solitary to swarming behavior in an effort to stop the devastating swarms from happening, and scientists have found that they can stimulate the switch in a variety of ways, including tickling the legs of locusts with a paintbrush, which is the sensation locusts get from other locusts when they're crowded together. Now, in a paper in this week's Science, Steve Rogers and colleagues have found that behavioral switch in the locusts is linked to the common neurotransmitter serotonin. The research may help in dealing with these harmful insects, although the discovery does not provide an immediate pest control solution. I spoke with Rogers from his office at Cambridge University.
What we're looking at is how locusts change their behavior. One thing everyone knows about locusts is that they swarm. But what's not so well appreciated is that they spend most of their lives, or in fact many generations, in a form which doesn't swarm at all. And not only doesn't swarm, is actively repelled by other locusts. So what we've found is a mechanism, a neurochemical mechanism, by which they change from actively detesting each other and running away to aggregating into groups.
Before we get to the neurochemical mechanism, How do you get these desert locusts to switch from this solitary behavior to this swarming or gregarious behavior?
The key feature of locust biology is this idea of phase change. So they change from being actively repelled by each other to being mutually attracted. And how that works in the wild is that they have to be forced into contact with each other, and often what drives that is hunger. And as they come into contact with each other, a combination of tactile stimulation directed towards the hind legs and sight and smell stimuli from other locusts leads to this change in behavior. And it occurs very, very rapidly. Once they're forced into a group, they'll change completely from being repelled to being attracted between 2 and 4 hours.
Could you and your team induce this behavioral change from solitary?
Yes, it's very tractable in the laboratory setting. In fact, with regard to the mechanosensory stimulus, we can sit there with a paintbrush and tickle their hind legs. And these are long experiments. You have to sit there and repeatedly touch the hind legs. But if you do that repeatedly over the course of a couple of hours, and you can measure the behavior, and there's another pathway where they need to see and smell other locusts, and that will also drive them to gregarize. It's one of the really interesting things about it is that both stimuli, both pathways, one of which is coming in through the hind legs and into the thoracic part of the central nervous system, and another one through the eyes and the antennae, which smell, and coming in the first instance in the brain, both of these pathways are equally effective at inducing gregarization, and it seems to proceed at exactly the same rate.
Now, what exactly then is this neurochemical stimulus? What's going on?
Well, what we had is we knew the stimuli that are involved, and we knew we had this rather narrow window in which behavior is completely transformed. So we did this broad sweep analysis looking at a number of different chemicals, and we found one thing that changes within this critical window, and this one chemical was serotonin, which is a very common brain chemical. It's found in nearly all animals, including humans, and is really important in regulating the way in which animals interact with each other, whether this is aggression or mood, or in this case, phase change.
What's the neurotransmitter serotonin acting on in the desert locust? Is it a part of the brain or something else?
What we have in locusts is their central nervous system is more distributed than that of a mammal. And what we have is a brain, as you might expect, in the head, but also a series of what are called segmental ganglia, which arrange like a string of beads all the way down the body. And each one of these ganglia controls a single segment. And what we found is that the critical ganglia involved in phase change are ones actually in the thorax, which is the part of the body which is actually mostly involved in controlling the legs and wings. So what we found is, in the sort of starting point for our paper, is we looked at how serotonin changed as they became gregarious. And one of the advantages we've got in our lab is we have a very precise sort of quantitative measure of behavior. So we can reduce a whole range of different things which change as locusts become gregarious. And there's hardly an aspect of the behavior that doesn't change over time. We can reduce that to a single index. And what we're able to do is correlate the degree to which they become gregarious with the amount of serotonin. And there's a strong positive correlation. The more serotonin there was in this thoracic ganglia, the more gregarious the locusts were when we looked at the behavior.
So artificially raising serotonin levels was sufficient to induce this gregarious or swarming behavior?
Yes, we were able to inject them with serotonin directly into the thoracic ganglia, and we saw a shift in behavior towards gregariousness. And we used serotonin itself, and we used a mixture of two agonists of serotonin, drugs which mimic the effect of serotonin, and they also caused a shift in behavior. And not only that, we could block the action of serotonin, either by interfering with the way it's made in the locust or by using inhibitors, the things which sit in the receptor and prevent serotonin actually activating them. And we found that if we did that and we put them in a crowd or tickled them or gave them sight and smell, they didn't gregarize at all. They just stayed solitarious.
Could this knowledge be applied to prevent swarming?
I think what we've done is we've sort of opened the black box of how this mechanism works. I think serotonin is so universal as a signaling molecule that it doesn't directly lend itself to a control method. But in terms of the receptors which it activates and downstream of that, a lot of those substances are proteins. They're much more variable in different animal species. And I think that may very well lend itself to a much more direct intervention where you could target a control measure and prevent them actually getting together into groups and then migrating. But that's a little way down the line yet.
So what's next then?
The work we've done is really at the interface between the animal's internal environment, what's going on within its central nervous system, and how locusts interact with each other, both in the first instance in small groups and then ever bigger ones. And this is escalating up into large-scale population movements. So one aspect of the work we're now pursuing, particularly in Sydney, is looking at how swarms really develop on the sort of geographic and ecological scale. And at the other extreme, we're looking at what's happening at a sort of circuit level within the central nervous system. We're looking at the signaling pathway, what serotonin affects next in this process of changing behavior. And we're also looking at the properties of the neurons themselves, how they are changed during this process of gregarization, and whether we can explain the change in behavior through the altered properties of nerve cells and how they communicate with each other. I think in terms of the control issue, the really important thing is knowing what the receptors are like for serotonin, because I think that will be the point of attack for any sort of application for controlling locusts. That's the level which we may have something which is specific to locusts and isn't generic. And I think at the population level, we need to know how these groups nucleate, how these small groups of locusts living on their own come together into small groups. We need to understand how that process begins and escalates and what sort of features of the environment drive that initial process of gregarization. Because if we're going to apply some sort of specific control mechanism, something to break up this process of swarm formation, we need to catch it early. So it really does need this two-pronged approach. A, to understand within the locust how serotonin is acting on the central nervous system to give us some sort of pharmacological, if you like, point of attack. And at the ecological scale, we need to understand how and where these processes are initiated in the environment.
Steve Rogers, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Steve Rogers is corresponding author of a paper on how serotonin mediates behavior in desert locusts. Read the paper in this week's Science. 5 days before Barack Obama became president, Democratic lawmakers unveiled an $825 billion stimulus package. Following the money and here with a policy update, here's Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny.
I'm here with Keiko Izumi, who's director of the R&D Budget and Policy Program of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Kay, what can you tell us about the current state of the economic stimulus package and how is science faring?
Well, Congress right now is trying to put together a very large piece of legislation to help the economy get back on its feet. The price tag is about $825 billion. And science does have a significant part in that. We estimate that about $13.3 billion in research and development funding is in the latest draft of the stimulus. And that could mean big impacts for the U.S. science and engineering community.
Are there any particular agencies or programs that are going to do especially well?
Well, I think there are four areas of science that would do very well in the stimulus so far. And they are basic competitiveness or innovation research, biomedical research, energy R&D, and climate change-related programs. So those four areas are high priorities for the Congress and the new administration, and they do very well in the stimulus package so far.
What are the next steps?
Well, next steps are for the House and the Senate to come to an agreement on their separate versions and to try to get a final bill approved for President Obama to sign. Their goal is to try to have it done by the middle of February. And then at that time, we may begin to see some very large investments in science infrastructure, in research grants, and also science and math education to help get the economy back on its feet.
Thank you very much, Kay, for sharing that with us.
Thank you.
That was Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny talking with Kay Koizumi, who oversees the AAAS Research and Development Budget and Policy Program. Policy updates on the Science Podcast are brought to you by Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. China's rapid economic development has meant some growing pains, particularly in terms of protests and other mass disturbances. Numbers are hard to come by, but in 2005, there were 51,000 reported conflicts over ecological issues, including contaminated water, dust, and landslides. Now, in this week's Science, news writer Rich Stone reports that the government is asking social scientists to try to predict these mass disturbances, which are expected to increase this year. I spoke with Stone from Beijing.
Until recently, Chinese social scientists had no opportunity to study mass disturbances. So mass disturbances can include everything from protests against local government malfeasance all the way up to what we saw in Tibet last year was protests against Chinese rule. So it's a blanket term for the type of social unrest which China has been experiencing lately.
Have there been a lot of these mass disturbances in China recently, or are we only just beginning to hear about them now for some reason?
The frequency of the mass disturbances has been rising. It seems to go hand in hand with the development of the country's overall economy. So as China gets more wealthy, the rich-poor gap grows, and that is one of the precipitating factors that has caused this rising tide of social unrest. That said, the Chinese government for a long time was quite concerned about reports of these protests and the effect that this might have on possibly triggering wider unrest. So the Chinese government suppressed news reports of these protests until relatively recently. And the change in policy is directly a result of Chinese social scientists who advised the Chinese central government that it would be much better to promote a stable China if the news of these local protests was more widely broadcast.
Now that the social scientists in China are studying these mass disturbances, what are they doing with their studies, with their research?
Well, one team at the Chinese Academy of Sciences, the Institute of Psychology, they have been gathering information since 2004, and they feel that they've gotten such a thorough understanding about the precipitating factors. They feel that they can forecast the likelihood of protests, and they did an experiment. Whereas data gathered in 2007 on social attitudes, the way people were feeling, and they gathered data on the incidences of crime and other factors, the number of complaints lodged against local government. And they were able to correlate the feelings of the local population and the statistics of what was happening at the county level. And based on that, they were able to forecast the likelihood that a particular county would experience a mass incident in 2008. And they did this for 35 counties, and they were correct for 33.
And what precisely does their prediction consist of?
Well, they can't predict the exact timing because it's never certain when the trigger might occur, which would spark a protest. And that's one thing that another group in China, which studies this phenomenon, the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, their scientists have made that point that they don't feel comfortable trying to forecast because, you know, you just don't know when that trigger will occur. But the Academy of Sciences team has said, even though they don't know precisely when simmering grievances will explode, they can say with what they call a fair degree of certainty that a particular county is poised for a protest in a given year.
What, if anything, is the government doing or plan to do with this predictive data, these forecasts of mass disturbances?
It's not clear yet. The Chinese Academy of Sciences has briefed the central government about the potential, how they might be able to forecast counties that are poised for unrest. And certainly the researchers at the Academy of Sciences and the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences feel that the central government has consistently strived to rectify policy failures at the local government level, which, according to the research, are the major cause of most of the protests. So they feel that it's within the government's, central government's interest to try to implement this kind of forecasting. And the Academy of Sciences team has already been asked to advise it on how to monitor social attitudes among the population that had been traumatized by the earthquake last May. Certainly, the feelings of the people who are trying to recover from the earthquake and how they feel toward the local government, whether they feel the local government has properly assisted them to recover from the earthquake. It's in the central government's interest to know whether there is any simmering grievances in the earthquake's hit areas. So this does appear to be the first actual usage of this kind of forecasting.
So a social monitoring system to preserve social stability is the official word.
Yeah, well, it's certainly, that's one of the overarching objectives of China's top leaders. The president, Hu Jintao, has vowed to create what he calls a harmonious society. And the challenge of ensuring that China is stable is quite difficult when the number of protests are clearly rising quite rapidly. Now, the main concern of researchers now is the effect of the financial crisis, the global crisis, and how it will affect China. There are tens of millions of people who have gone back to their hometowns for the Lunar New Year festival. And many of these are migrant workers who are now jobless. There was a recent report of some 670,000 manufacturers had to close in the last few months of 2008 due to sagging demand for Chinese goods. So you have a lot of people out of work. They're restless. They've gone back to their hometowns. And according to the social scientists, this is a very nerve-wracking period because they just don't know whether all these unemployed people are going to be satisfied with trying to readapt to life in their home villages after having a taste of life in China's big cities. So there's a lot of concern that social unrest is going to rise in the first half of 2009.
Now, you said the president there wants to create a harmonious society. Harmonious means potentially lots of things. This information potentially could be used to suppress such protests rather than cure the ills that may cause them.
Yes, well, certainly some experts have warned of that possibility. So the critical concern is that the central government will perhaps use this forecasting to suppress disturbances that threaten to become region-wide problems. And certainly what happened last March, the Lhasa riots, that disturbance spread into neighboring provinces of Sichuan and in Gansu. So any kind of phenomenon that would threaten to spill over into a regional problem, I think there is that concern about how such forecasting might be used. But the Chinese scientists who I've talked to have said that the central government consistently has tried to address the central problem of most of the unrest, and that's poor local governance.
Rich Stone, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob, and Chunjia Kwaila.
And a happy Lunar New Year to you too, Rich.
Thanks again, Rob.
Science news writer Rich Stone reports on predicting protests in China. Read his article in this week's Science. Now, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science news. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to talk about a dung beetle that has stopped eating dung and turned into a killer. We're going to look at a study that's trying to figure out whether eating less improves memory. And finally, we're going to discuss the real purpose of Triceratops horns.
Well, let's start with the dung beetle that's turned into a killer. No feces for this species, Dave?
Quite. Rob, as you can probably guess from the name, dung beetles have a reputation for eating dung. In fact, until this study was published, biologists thought that's pretty much all they ate. But there has been some evidence that they also eat rotting fruit, and some of them have even been found dining on dead insects. But what's unusual about this new dung beetle species, which is called Deltochilum valgum, is that this species seems to have abandoned the dung-eating lifestyle completely and turned into a killer.
What's it kill? What's it eat?
Well, this team of researchers went out into the deep Peruvian rainforest, and there's hundreds of dung beetle species in this rainforest, and they set traps with dung, and they set traps with rotting fruit, but they also set traps with live millipedes, because the lead researcher on this project had sometimes observed dung beetles feasting on dead millipedes. So he said, I wonder if they go after live millipedes. And what they found after 11 months of setting these traps was, first of all, they recorded 132 species of dung beetle, and they recorded the behavior of 100,000 individuals. And they found that, as they suspected, most of them were either eating dung or they were eating the rotten fruit. But this one species exclusively went after the live millipedes. And they didn't just go after them. They went after them in a pretty gory way. These dung beetles have these serrated heads, and what they were doing with their heads was using them to pry between the segments of the millipede, and this would split the millipede apart, and then they would feed on the millipede's insides. So a pretty graphic strategy, and also a very dramatic change in eating habits. You're talking about a dung beetle that has gone from being a scavenger, just sort of eating what's left behind on the forest floor, to being an active killer.
Well, how can researchers really be sure of that? I mean, it just sounds like this is something they hadn't observed before. Not that the dung beetle actually evolved.
Well, that's a good point. But what suggests that this is actually evolution in action is these particular features of this dung beetle, this serrated head, and also it has these sort of unique adaptations on its leg that literally allow it to rip the millipede apart. Those are things that are not seen in other dung beetles. And what they're saying is because of these adaptations, they would expect that there would be this whole new diversification of dung beetle species where you'd have this whole new group of dung beetles, not just this one species, turning into killers. And indeed, after this paper was published, the team has observed other species of dung beetles killing millipedes. So it suggests that this is something that may have started fairly recently and is just starting to explode among dung beetles.
Well, from the dietary habits of dung beetles to the dietary restrictions that may lead to improved memory. Eating less, Dave, will help me remember more?
That's the idea. And ever since the 1930s, there's been this theory that if we eat less, a lot less, and we're not just talking about cutting a few calories out of our diet, we're talking about trimming our caloric intake by as much as 30%, so severe restriction in diet, that this is healthier for our bodies, that it'll help us live longer, that it will reduce heart disease. And there's been some evidence for this in rodents and non-human primates. But the evidence in humans has been rather sketchy, and that's because it's really hard to do these studies, and people are usually dealing with small sample sizes. And so for this new study, the researchers tried to focus on a larger group of people. They were after this idea of, well, if eating less makes us healthier overall, does it also have cognitive benefits? And in this case, does it help improve memory? And for this study, they looked at 50 old people, people with an average age of about 60 years old, and all of them were overweight. And they divided them into three groups. And for one group, they said, for 3 months, eat 30% fewer calories than you usually do. And for another group, they said, pretty much keep the same diet, but eat more unsaturated fatty acids. And the reason they said this is because there have been other studies that have linked unsaturated fatty acids to cognitive improvements.
Found in things like salmon and olives, right?
Exactly. And for the final group, they said, don't do anything. This is our control group, and just keep on eating and living like you have been. otherwise. And so after 3 months, they asked these participants to take a memory test. And this was basically just trying to remember a series of words. And the participants had taken the same memory test before they started their diets. And what they found is that the people who cut their calories by 30% performed 20% better on the memory test than the other two groups. In fact, the other two groups really showed no improvement at all.
It sounds like the confounding factor here might be that the people were overweight, so now they were actually eating maybe more about what they ought to be eating.
Well, that's one point that an expert raised when commenting on the study was that overweight people tend to have a whole series of other problems. And one of those problems is sleep apnea. This is problems when you're sleeping, and that itself can contribute to cognitive problems. So if it could be that these people are just improving their memory because they're eliminating some of the debilitating factors of being overweight, not because cutting calories itself has any sort of impact on cognitive function. But the bottom line is the researchers say this is just a first step. You know, more studies like these are needed to really determine whether there is this link between severe calorie reduction and improvements in memory or even improvements in longevity. The important message being that moderation in lifestyle, especially dietary lifestyle, can be beneficial for our mental activities.
Well, from how dietary lifestyle potentially impacts our mental activities to how the Triceratops used its head, what was the real function of the horns on the Triceratops' head?
Well, Rob, if you've seen any of those old black and white movies that show dinosaurs fighting, one thing they often show is the Triceratops, which has these very dramatic horns. It's got this horn coming out of its nose, and it's got these two horns above its eyebrows, and it's busy goring a Tyrannosaurus Rex or even butting heads with another Triceratops. And those early movies were sort of based on the idea that Triceratops use their horns the same way we think of animals like deer and mountain goats using their horns. In other words, to fight each other, maybe for territory, for mates, or whatever. But over the years, that idea has taken a hit. Paleontologists have looked at other animals that have displays, like even like peacocks, and they've said, maybe the horns were just for display. You know, some animals use various body parts not to fight, but to show, hey, I'm very healthy or I'm very fit. And especially for males, it's a way to prove to females that they're a good mate. So they said, well, maybe these horns weren't used for battle at all. Maybe they just had much more symbolic purpose.
So what evidence did the researchers consider in this study?
Well, the researchers wanted to be really comprehensive in this study, and they looked at 400 fossilized skulls. And some of these were from Triceratops, but some of them were from another horned dinosaur called Centrosaurus. And Centrosaurus also has three horns, but its nose horn was much bigger than the one on Triceratops. And the horns above its eyes were smaller, so it looked a bit more like a rhinoceros than Triceratops did. And the reason the team compared these two dinosaurs is they figured, well, because of the way Centrosaurus is built, it probably didn't have the head-to-head combat that some people have associated with Triceratops. Maybe it was more involved with maybe doing body blows or something like that. And indeed, what they found when they looked at the Triceratops skulls was they found a lot of fractures and lesions around this crest, actually, which is called a frill, which is sort of this almost armor-like thing Triceratops have that extends behind their head. And they were finding a lot of damage on that. And that suggests that the Triceratops were using their heads a lot for combat, likely using their horns to fight other Triceratops or other dinosaurs. Whereas the Centrosaurus didn't really show this type of damage, which was a good control for a Triceratops because it said, you know, just because you have horns doesn't mean, you know, you're necessarily using them for battle. And so overall, what this team's concluding is that it looks like these early filmmakers were right. It looks like the Triceratops were actually using their horns as weapons and not necessarily as show, although they are open to the possibility that the horns had what they call sort of a Swiss Army-like function where they may have been used for battle, but they may have also been used for display, especially for male Triceratops, to woo mates.
Well, that's good that they did the comparison, but what about puncture marks or evidence that the Triceratops was fighting other animals or indeed other Triceratops?
Well, that's a good point. It was a point actually raised by Jack Horner, who's one of the world's most famous paleontologists. He's actually the paleontologist that advised the special effects guys on the Jurassic Park movies. And what he said is he really would expect that if these horns were being used as weapons, you should be seeing a lot more puncture marks in these fossilized skulls, which the researchers aren't really seeing. So at least for him, he's not completely sold on this idea that these horns were primarily used for battle. And that's certainly a criticism this team is keeping in mind. But their next step is to look at even more fossilized skeletons. And they actually want to look at T-Rexes to see, do they have damage on their ribs perhaps damaged from a Triceratops horn, which would be even more evidence that the Triceratops were using their horns for battle.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, on Science Now, we're looking into a story about geoengineering of the ocean. And this involves this idea of throwing iron actually into the ocean as a way to increase phytoplankton blooms and draw CO2 out of the atmosphere. It's very controversial, and there's been some new studies suggesting how efficacious it might be. And on the policy blog, we're following President Obama's first days in office. What is he saying about science? What are his advisors saying about science? And we're also tracking some science developments abroad. There's a big brouhaha actually happening in France right now between President Sarkozy and French scientists about the future of science in that country. So definitely check out Science Now for our research findings and the policy blog for everything you ever wanted to know about science policy.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to our policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. Finally, today we read from your letters to Science Magazine. Joining me is the letters editor, Jennifer Sills.
This month, we start with a letter in response to an address by AAAS President David Baltimore in the October 24th issue. In that address, called A Global Perspective on Science and Technology, Baltimore acknowledges that for the past several years, he has denied responsibility for actions taken by the U.S. government that have undermined science. And he wonders whether other U.S. scientists feel that they have denied responsibility, too.
Jason Yang at the University of Virginia writes, "As a graduate student training for a career in the academy, I wonder at what point in my career it will be most appropriate to begin thinking about exercising responsibility for my nation's actions. Clearly, there are good reasons why scientists and engineers need to consider stepping outside our laboratories to serve our nation. Yet there are few moments on the road to tenure where it would be wise to step from the bench to engage in advocacy or policy."
Yang questions how and when it is most appropriate to lead students to consider questions of responsibilities inherent in citizenship. He concludes, "As I begin to form my own scientific identity, I wonder what it will mean for my fellow socially conscious students and me to exercise our voices in the world we'll inherit. I wonder if there will be meaningful opportunities for us to participate without having to first get inducted into the national academies, or if we really have as much potential to shape the world as we want to believe."
You can read Yang's full letter in the January 9th issue of Science. Our next letter addresses the potential to shape the world, not by graduate students, but by the Republican Party. Robert White writes in from Carnegie Mellon University with a letter that admonishes the Republican Party for not supporting science.
White writes, "Derisive statements from Republican leaders about experiments involving grizzly bear DNA and fruit fly studies related to medical discoveries have revealed a lack of understanding about what science and engineering mean for our country. Throughout the campaign for president, it was clear that science was not a high priority."
This has not always been the case, White continues. It was widely known that the first President Bush relied heavily on his science advisor, Alan Bromley. As Bromley wrote in the preface to his book, The President's Scientists, "No president in memory has been more sensitive than George Bush Sr. to the importance of science and technology, nor more willing to actively support them as an investment in the national future." White concludes, "Learning the right lessons from this election will make all the difference 2 years from now. For the Republican Party to become relevant again, support of science can't be solely a Democratic issue. It is a national one."
You can read White's full letter in the January 23rd issue of Science. Our final letter suggests a way to reverse the current global crisis. No, not the current global economic crisis, though we did receive a number of letters about how best to allocate the $700 billion that the U.S. has set aside as part of its bailout package. Instead, Jabouri Ghazoul from the Institute of Terrestrial Ecosystems in Switzerland writes in about what would happen if we use those $700 billion to address the species extinction crisis.
Ghazoul writes, "An estimated 10 million species populate the Earth. To ward against extinction, we could equitably award $70,000 to each and every one of these 10 million species from our $700 billion cash injection. The intertidal bryozoans of Scotland's west coast would alone receive more than $3 million. The 43 species of ants from E.O. Wilson's single leguminous tree at the Tambopata Reserve in Peru could pool their resources to buy about 150,000 hectares of Amazonian forest at $20 per hectare.
On the other hand, Gazul writes, species that are doing just fine could bank their share of funds. The roughly 7.5 million species not considered at risk could bank their collective $525 billion, hedging their bets against some future need. The interest thereby generated could subsidize species with greater financial and conservation needs, and if reinvested, could maintain the capital stock. Some species will undoubtedly be declared genetically bankrupt and lost forever, but many more will be offered a lifeline to recovery, flooding the global ecological system with confidence. Growth will be restored. But where would $700 billion come from? Gazul asks.
From borrowing, of course. Gazul concludes, we have been borrowing from nature's capital for nigh on the last few centuries. Is it not time we paid some back?
You can read Gazul's full letter in the January 23rd issue of Science.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Rob.
Jennifer Sills is the letters editor for Science Magazine. And that wraps up the January 30th, 2009 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.